Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Shasai and I'll be with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, Federal Sports Minister Pascal Saint-Onge is keeping an eye on Hockey Canada as she's working to ensure a safe sporting environment for athletes across the country.
We're waiting to see what kind of people are going to be voted on the next board. I'm hoping to see a whole lot more diversity, especially women, and also people from diverse communities, but also diverse expertise.
Atlantic Canada's first transition house designed for Muslim women and children opens in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Every single night, there are 6,000 women and children sleeping in shelters. And at the same time, on every single one of those nights, about 600 women and children are being turned away because there's no space.
Controversy continues over New Brunswick's Premier Blaine Higgs' decision to axe French immersion in Canada's only officially bilingual province.
I think it's really important to be able to speak the language, especially in this province, and to be able to access the better jobs at the end of the day.
And Fisheries and Oceans Canada investigates the death of four humpback whales in Haida Gwaii, BC. This could strangely be good news for the humpback population.
We're seeing a population rebound, but I think we're also seeing movement into inshore waters, maybe from Southeast Alaska into our waters. We have very productive inshore waters. We're seeing a lot of krill, a lot of herring.
These stories and more on Viewpoints. Welcome.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
We start things off in Quebec. Hockey Canada has been under scrutiny since information came to light this spring that the organization was involved in an out-of-court settlement for a sexual assault case involving hockey players from the 2018 junior hockey team. This brought attention to the toxic culture that can exist within sports. Pascal Saint-Onge, Federal Minister of Sports and Member of Parliament for Brome-Missisquoi, immediately addressed the situation by cutting federal funding to Hockey Canada and by setting certain conditions that she expects the organization to meet. This included that Hockey Canada file with the Office of the Sports Integrity Commissioner and that the entire board of directors resign, which they did. But as of now, not all conditions have been met yet. Saint-Onge is taking various steps to ensure a safe sporting environment for athletes across the country and in all sports. Journalist Taylor McClure posted in Knowlton, Quebec, sat down this summer with Pascal Saint-Onge, and a few days ago she had the opportunity to welcome her back to talk about Hockey Canada and the conditions imposed on them.
Well, they've worked on some of them, but not all of these conditions have been fulfilled yet. The most important part for me was for them to sign up with the Office of the Sports Integrity Commissioner, which is a milestone. It's going to be imposed on all federally funded organizations before the next funding cycle, which starts in April 2023. But it was a priority for me to have Hockey Canada sign on, mainly because for cases of abuse or maltreatment, now athletes, but also members of the public have somewhere to turn to, and also for OSIC to be able to investigate whether there are cultural issues within the sport that needs to be tackled, make recommendations, and help the organization get better. So that was extremely important. However, the financial audit is still not over. We should receive a report at some point. Also, we're still waiting to see permanent changes in the organization. Right now, the board has resigned. We're waiting to see what kind of people are going to be voted on the next board. That's going to be really important. I'm hoping to see a whole lot more diversity, especially women, and also people from diverse communities, but also diverse expertise to bring, for example, better governance expertise on the board, because that was one of the problems that was highlighted.
That was actually my next question, was like, it's public knowledge that the entire board of directors decided to step down. And I was just going to ask you to comment on that and what it means for Hockey Canada, hockey itself, and for athletes. The last time you were here, you mentioned that Canadians lost faith in the hockey body's leadership.
Yeah, I think this was a very important step. Because what we've heard from the previous board of directors was that they didn't have very good understanding of the depth of the problematics within the organization in regards to sexual violence, but also the culture of violence in the organization. So it was clear, and it became more clear as we testified in front of the Heritage Committee, that there needed to be an extensive change within the organization, and it needs to start at the board because they are the one hiring all the directors and the key members that play very important roles with the players and building a strong entourage and good training and good education system for the players so that they know more about consent and about the sexual abuse. So that was really important, but there's an election that's going to happen sometime this December, and we'll see, because, you know, we need to see change, and I'm really hoping that the voting members bring in new people.
What steps have you taken as the Minister of Sports at the federal level? What steps, other steps have you taken over the last few months to ensure that something like this does not happen again? Have you been working with other sport institutions to work on a more secure environment?
Well, a very important step was taken in Canada by creating a new independent mechanism that could investigate on individual cases, but also make cultural assessments about toxic culture in sports. So that started on June 20th, and that was really important. It's a game changer for national athletes in Canada. Now I'm working also with my counterparts from the provinces and territories to make sure that such independent mechanisms are created in every jurisdiction so that all athletes are protected, no matter the level that they're at. Because one of the stories that we keep on hearing about is gymnastics. Yes. And yes, there's been problems within the national organization, but also in local clubs and in provincial clubs. So my goal is to make sure that all athletes across Canada are covered, that they have a safe place to turn to. So that's really important. And the other thing that I'm working on right now is surrounding myself with experts that can help us think about the next funding framework that we're going to put in place starting in April 2023, so that we can help organizations have better governance structures and practices, better financial transparency, and also better expertise about abuse and maltreatment, so that more training and education happens within the organization for athletes, officials, coaches, leaders, because I really feel like this is the only way that we're going to change the culture in sport, is if everyone is involved and if collectively we use every tools and every opportunity that we have to talk about these issues and you know, create change in sport.
And I remember the last time that you were here, like when this whole Hockey Canada case came about, that you had people calling into your office asking questions and things like that, and you were trying to answer those questions as best as you could. Is this something that you're still doing? Are you, for people who are concerned or who have had an experience of violence themselves, is this something that you're still doing?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Anytime I come in the writing and I meet people, a lot of them talk to me about, well, first of all, how offended they were by Hockey Canada's attitude and their management of sexual abuse, but also about their own experiences in sport. And I'm planning on visiting a lot of arenas this winter, just going into arenas and talking with parents and coaches and players to know more about, you know, what they think and what they're doing in their own teams to have better communication and to fight those issues.
I actually spoke with the Minister of Sports in Quebec here, Isabelle Charest, who is working on reforming the sporting environment in Quebec. Like you mentioned before, this is something that you're hoping to see across the country.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And you know, Quebec has been, you know, forward-thinking in these issues, and Isabelle is doing great work. I know that she's extremely committed to fight abuse and maltreatment in sport. She's herself an ex-athlete, and I know that her experience is helping a lot. She's doing great things. And, you know, we often have meetings, all sport ministers across Canada, and we're trying to work with everyone to improve the situation in other provinces. But last meeting that we had, it was during the Canada Games, and they all committed to creating such an independent mechanism within their own province or territory, or to sign on with the Office of the Sport Integrity Commissioner. I'm following their work, and I hope that soon all jurisdictions have such mechanisms. My goal in all this is to bring back joy in sport, because we hear terrible stories these days, and it's important to acknowledge what's happening. It's important to recognize it, it's important to make changes, sustainable changes that are going to permanently change the sport culture in Canada. But the main thing is to bring joy back in sport.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Atlantic Canada's first transition house designed for Muslim women and children fleeing domestic violence and homelessness opened in Halifax in November. Nisa Homes partnered with the Yuma Society, a national nonprofit charity, to open the shelter. Nisa Homes program director Yasmin Youssef said this house marks their 9th location opening across Canada. As of now, the home is funded solely by community donations. Youssef explains that domestic violence statistics have increased since the pandemic and that the center saw a need for additional housing for the women and children escaping abusive relationships. The shelter is helping them to find a job, locate housing and assist them with mental health and emotional resources, and provides, of course, counselors to women and children in need. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, journalist Sarah Gouda spoke with Yasmin Youssef, program director at Nisa Homes.
We see the changing demographics when we look at Canada. We see, you know, the increased numbers when it comes to immigration, and we see things are changing, especially in a city like Halifax and a province like Nova Scotia. They are doing a lot to try and attract more immigrants and more newcomers. And there's a need for them. But at the same time, when we are accepting them and welcoming them and, you know, requesting that they come to Canada, we need to make sure that, you know, our services, our infrastructure is there to support them. Unfortunately, the reality is domestic violence is occurring in many different countries, many different religions, many different nationalities. It really doesn't discriminate. But at the same time, what we're also seeing is that, you know, aside from the domestic violence, we're seeing a lot of homelessness increasing because of, you know, the economic situation, because of COVID, because of everything. There was research done called Shelter Voices, and it found that on average, every single night, there are 6,000 women and children sleeping in shelters because home is not safe. And at the same time, on every single one of those nights, about 600 women and children are being turned away because there's no space. So there's a problem regardless of, you know, talking about which demographic we're targeting or what we're doing. There's a problem because there's not enough shelter spaces. There's a problem because, you know, housing is not affordable. There's very little income security. There's very little job security right now. So these are problems that exist. But when you start to look at, okay, you know, women that are marginalized, when you start looking at women that maybe don't have citizenship or have precarious status, or women that have disabilities, or women that, you know, are racialized or visible minorities. Yeah, so we're primarily catered towards immigrant, refugee, non-status, or Muslim women and children. So we do prioritize them. However, if we do have space and we do have a client that doesn't fall under one of these categories, we will for sure help. But we know that those populations, unfortunately, struggle more to access services because of language barriers, because of, challenges in understanding the system, or because of fear of deportation or immigration issues, or just a simple lack of feeling safe or welcome in certain environments. Unfortunately, we know hate crimes and Islamophobia are on the rise. So that does prevent a lot of women from reaching out for help. So the goal is that we make it available to them, but it's open to anyone. We have 12 beds, and usually it depends on, you know, the breakdown of how many women and children there are. But there are 12 beds available.
And how long would they be able to stay there for?
So they stay for about 3 months. And during those 3 months, the goal is to get them back on their feet. So the goal is to provide every kind of wraparound service to make sure that they have the right supports in place so that come the end of those 3 months, they have a place to move out to. And so we help them with their casework. We help them with finding jobs or income. We help them with finding housing. We help them with their emotional and mental health healing too. We have counselors. We have childcare workers that support the children. And obviously there's financial assistance, and we provide food in the homes, all of the basic necessities. But really the goal is that within those 3 months, There's a plan and there's a timeline that they follow that will hopefully, if things, you know, are okay and things go smoothly, they're able to move out and you know, become independent and self-sufficient soon after.
I'm curious that it's the first home to open for Muslim women and children that it took this long. But yeah, can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, you know, we started the conversations. I recall this very vividly because I was in Halifax in March for the National Domestic Violence Conference, and it finished literally 2 days before the country went in lockdown because of COVID. And that was when we had first started that conversation with local organizations and community members and community leaders. And then COVID happened, so things did get kind of delayed. But then we kind of restarted the conversation earlier this year, especially because we know with COVID, numbers have gone up, numbers of intimate partner violence, numbers of domestic violence have significantly increased. We've seen an increase ourselves, you know, in some of our other locations of 100% increase in the number of calls we were receiving.
When these women leave these houses, do you find they return to these houses, or do you find this program is successful in rehabilitating them?
We did do some kind of research with our previous clients, and we found that around 85% of women that come to NISA homes end up becoming self-sufficient and independent within a year from coming to us. So I wouldn't say right away, it takes time, but within a year, they're independent and self-sufficient, and that's 85%. So the vast majority are able to get back on their feet and are able to kind of support themselves and don't go back to their abusers. There is the remaining 15%. I wouldn't say that all of them do go back to their abusers. The research says that it takes a woman 7 attempts before she can actually leave an abusive relationship. You know, we've had clients that have come to us and gone back and then come again. And, you know, it's a journey. It's very hard to even kind of, you know, quantify that or you know, keep track of that. Because even afterwards, sometimes, you know, sometimes they move out and then they end up going back to their abuser. And so we have found that the vast majority are able to, you know, continue on and do not. I just want to put it out there that, you know, for any women, for anyone that is experiencing, even for men that are experiencing intimate partner violence or domestic violence, there are resources out there. There are services for those that want to learn more and want to help out. We're also, you know, always looking for support, and we're always looking for, you know, community members to help us spread the word, to raise awareness. At the end of the day, what we're doing is reactive. At the end of the day, you know, a service like this, unfortunately, is someone that is homeless, that doesn't have anywhere else to go, that's why they come to us. But the goal is that eventually we want to be more proactive. We want to improve the education and the awareness in our communities so that ultimately a home like ours is not needed.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're tuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
In New Brunswick, controversy continues over Blaine Higgs' decision to axe French immersion in Canada's only officially bilingual province. The controversial decision became widely known in October when then-Minister of Education Dominique Cardy announced his resignation in an explosive open letter. At the time, Cardy blasted Higgs, saying the premier had pushed the education department to abolish French immersion in September 2023. The province says French immersion will be replaced with a program geared towards better conversational French for all students. Supporters of that plan argue that immersion has failed to produce enough graduates fluent in French, while creating a two-tiered system of education in which students with learning challenges are concentrated in the non-immersion stream. But many questions remain about what exactly will replace the French immersion system, which some parents say is a crucial aspect of the education system, especially in New Brunswick. Critics of the government also point to the premier's push for a unilingual province dating back to the 1980s, when he ran for the leadership of the Anti-Bilingual Confederation of Regions Party, also called CORE. The planned abolition of French immersion in New Brunswick has provoked the wrath of some residents. A grassroots organization appears to be taking shape in Sackville, calling itself French Immersion Supporters in Sackville. People involved in the initiative held their first in-person meeting on November 29 at the Sackville Commons Co-op. About two dozen people turned out for the meeting. Journalist David Gordon Kosh was there.
My name is Sandy Riddle.
And why are you here tonight?
Concerned for my kids' education.
How old are your kids?
They are 7 and 8.
Why is it important for you that they have access to French immersion?
I think it's really important to be able to speak the language, especially in this province, and to be able to access the better jobs at the end of the day.
My name is Merrill Fullerton, and I have a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old. They're currently in French immersion. And like a lot of others here, I'm concerned about their education, the quality of their education, but also, I value the importance of a bilingual populace, and I want them to be a part of that. And also the cultural exposure, right? And the data also suggests that if you learn a second language, it's also easier to learn third language or a fourth language. So I really believe in early immersion and exposing our kids at a young age as much as possible. That's why I'm here and I'm very concerned.
So could I get you to state your name first?
Laura King. I have two children in French immersion. I started French immersion in grade 2 and am bilingual at this point. We lived in Montreal for many years, and I work now in New Brunswick. And I feel like it's really, really important to connect our French community as soon as possible, and our children's learning, even as early as 6 months, can make the world a difference to be able to communicate fluently with our culture here in New Brunswick.
My name is Valmai Goggin. I'm a parent of two young girls, one of whom is currently in grade 1 French immersion. The other one will be entering the school system in a few years. I recently moved back to New Brunswick, actually after living away for 15 years. And certainly one of the reasons that brought us back, outside of, family and job opportunities, was access to French immersion for our children. So to be in a position now where the only bilingual province in the country is looking at having the worst French program nationwide is mind-boggling, and it cannot happen.
And it seems like a real grassroots effort here. Do you see yourself getting organized and taking part in sort of this, I don't know, it seems like a nascent campaign to reverse the policy?
Yes, absolutely. This is a starting point. This is not going to fizzle out. There are a lot of very committed and passionate people here this evening, parents of young children, parents of children in the school system further down the line, and I'm sure parents of students who have gone through the system and are engaged to go through this battle again. So this is the beginning of a very strong effort from Sackville.
And those were the voices of some of the parents in attendance in Sackville to oppose the provincial government's planned abolition of French immersion in New Brunswick. The event featured two guest speakers, Memram Cook, Tantramar MLA, Megan Mitten, and Chris Collins, who is the executive director of Canadian Parents for French NB, or CPFNB. Collins spoke about a pilot program at Maplehurst Middle School in Moncton, which his group says could replace French immersion. Here's Chris Collins.
Well, the Maplehurst is a pilot program that we think may be a precursor to what French second language training will look like in a year's time. And what it is is they're blending the classes. They in grade 7, for example, they've got grade 3, grade 5 French immersion mixed up with post-intensive French students or core French students. And they're getting 25% of their lessons a day taught in French. Occasionally, some of the little bit of math may be spoken in French, or a little bit of maybe every second social studies class. But essentially, all they're getting is a French class and every second social studies class taught in French.
How does that compare to what's currently in place in French immersion?
Well, at that level, they should be getting 70% of their French in their classes in French. In the early grades, it's 90, and in high school, it's 25. They're being shortchanged, and what they're worried about is what happens to them when they meet up with the kids that are getting true French immersion for the last 2 years in the other feeding schools.
That was Chris Collins, executive director of Canadian Parents for French NB. Also present at yesterday's meeting was local Green Party MLA Megan Mitten. She told the crowd that community organizing would be required to reverse the government's decision.
This decision, in fact, actually doesn't even need to go through the legislature. They're just doing it. They're just abolishing French immersion.
It's an executive decision.
It's just an executive decision. And frankly, it looks like it's coming from the Executive Council office. We need our civil society to organize and put pressure on government to change this decision and get on the right path in our education system, and frankly, for other things as well. People organizing, making themselves heard, speaking up to government, speaking publicly, is the only thing that's going to help move the needle. In the legislature, we've asked questions, we've debated motion, which the government voted down. There needs to be pressure on this government. There needs to be pressure on the Higgs government to change their plan. And frankly, I don't think they have a very clear plan. It's certainly not a good plan, but they need to stop what they're doing.
And that was Memram Cook, Tinchmar MLA Megan Mitten, speaking at the Sackville Commons Co-op. It was the first ever in-person meeting of a grassroots group calling itself French Immersion Supporters in Sackville.
Fisheries and Oceans Canada, or the DFO, reports a higher than average number of humpback whale deaths near the coast of Haida Gwaii in British Columbia. But this could be due to a healthy population, strangely. Since the beginning of October, the DFO has investigated four humpback whale carcasses that have washed onto the shores of Haida Gwaii. Marine Mammal Coordinator for the DFO, Paul Cottrell, explained that they often see an average of 5 to 10 humpback deaths a year, but it's unusual to see so many in 1 month. Morgan Budden spoke with Marine Mammal Coordinator for Fisheries and Oceans Canada, Paul Cottrell.
We sampled our necropsy four animals since the start of October there, and two have shown blunt force trauma consistent with vessel strike. The other two, we're still waiting on sample and tissue for all of them, so we don't have final reports yet. But the other two, we don't have a definitive cause of death yet. And I think the two that have shown blunt force trauma, we still need the final report to confirm cause of death.
Cottrell explained that this increase in humpback deaths could be coinciding with an increased humpback population.
We're seeing a population rebound, but I think we're also seeing movement into inshore waters, maybe from Southeast Alaska into our waters. We have very productive inshore waters. We're seeing a lot of krill, a lot of herring. So I think they're kind of drawn to food sources, but also hopefully reflective of a healthy ecosystem and lots of prey for them. So I think it's a combination of probably multiple factors, but just great to see. The unique thing about this is having, you know, four or five in 1 month is much, it's a bit of a blip, a high blip. So we're definitely interested and going to continue to be vigilant to see if this trend continues, and we hope it doesn't. But yeah, I mean, part of that is because we have more humpbacks and we're going to see more humpback death. But the important thing that we're looking at is why they died, and if there is that human cause of death, whether it's entanglement or vessel strike, really important for management. And if we need to look at implementing some sort of management actions that may minimize those human-caused deaths.
Cottrell explained why their research into the deaths is so significant now that the humpback population seems to be moving into the area.
We've got a lot more humpbacks that have moved into inshore waters in the last decade, which has been fantastic, kind of moving back to where humpbacks used to occur in inshore waters. So there's big movement and large number of animals, which is wonderful. And often you can see humpbacks now in inshore waters. But we're also seeing more interactions with fishing gear that's in inshore waters and also vessels that are inshore waters and even offshore as well. So that's what we want. That's why this research and these necropsies are so important, to look at that and get a sense of, if we can, where it may be occurring, and then look at, we know the specific vessel or the area, then we can look at what we may be able to look at in terms of management.
And that's all for us this week at Viewpoints. Our journalists were Morgan Budden, Taylor McClure, Sarah Gouda, David Gordon Kosh, National Coordinator Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Check out our website at canada-info.ca or our Twitter account, CanadaLJI. Take care of each other. See you next week. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosnai in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.